At least Mark's being careful, I told myself. That gives me confidence that Sarah will be safe. After that brief communication, Adam immediately wiped both email accounts from the internet. Now, here we are. We parked in front of the bus station in downtown Baltimore, the place bustling with activity even at sunset. I'm behind the wheel, Sarah in the passenger seat next to me. We fit right in, just two teenagers sitting in a crappy car in the middle of saying goodbye.
I keep waiting for the part where you try talking me out of going, Sarah says, her smile a little sad. You'll say it's too dangerous, we'll argue, you'll lose, and I'll end up going anyway.
It is dangerous, I reply, turning so I can face Sarah. And I don't want you to go.
That's more like it.
She takes my hand, lacing her fingers through mine. With my other hand, I run my fingers through her hair, eventually letting them rest gently on the back of her neck.
I pull her in a little closer. But it's no more dangerous than staying here with me, I finish. That's the overprotective John I know and love, she replies.
I'm not... I start to protest, but cut myself off when I see her teasing smile.
These goodbyes never get any easier, do they?
I shake my head.
No, they really don't.
We fall silent, holding tight to each other, watching the minutes on the dashboard clock slowly blink away. But at the textile factory, we didn't need to have a huge discussion about Sarah going to find Mark James. Everyone seemed to agree that it was the right thing to do. If Mark really had managed to acquire some crucial information on the Mogadorians, and if he was risking his life to help us, then we needed to return the favor. But the rest of the guard was still missing, and Adam's plan to strike the Mogadorian stronghold in D.C. seemed more and more like the smartest play, a necessary strike to gather intelligence and show those bastards that we were still in this fight. There's too much happening for us to put all our resources into catching up with Mark. Sarah made it easy by volunteering. Of course, sending her off alone on a potentially dangerous mission involving an ex-boyfriend isn't exactly my favorite idea. But I can't shake the feeling that the grim future I saw in Ella's dream is racing towards us. We need all the help we can get. If there's even the tiniest possibility that sending Sarah to Alabama could help us win this war, it's a chance we have to take. My own selfish feelings be damned. And anyway, she won't be totally alone on the trip. In the back seat, Bernie Kosar stands with his paws braced against the closed window, tail wagging furiously as he watches all the people zipping in and out of the bus station. My old friend seemed pretty wiped out after the battle in Chicago, but some of his energy came back when we got on the road. Once in paradise, he'd been my protector. Now he will do the same for Sarah.
I don't want you to think of me as your girlfriend right now, Sarah says out of the blue, totally composed.
I lean back a bit, squinting at her. That's going to be hard for me.
I want you to think of me as a soldier, she persists. A soldier in this war who's doing what needs to be done. I don't know exactly what I'll find down south, but I have this weird feeling that I'll be able to help you better from there. At the very least, when it comes to battles, I won't be around to slow you down.
You don't slow me down, I insist. But Sarah waves this objection away.
It's okay, John. I want to be with you. I want to see that you're okay. I want to see you win. But not every soldier can be on the front lines, you know. Some do more good when they're away from the action.
Sarah.
I've got my phone, she continues,
motioning to the hastily packed backpack at her feet. Inside it, she has a disposable cell phone that Malcolm bought, along with a few changes of clothes and a handgun.
I'll check in every 8 hours. But if I don't, you have to keep going. Keep fighting.
I get what she's trying to do. Sarah doesn't want me rushing off to Alabama if she misses one of her check-in phone calls. She wants my head in the game. Maybe she can sense it, too. That we're nearing the end of this fight. Or at least crossing a point of no return. Sarah looks into my eyes.
This is bigger than us, John.
Bigger than us, I repeat. Knowing it's the truth. Yet wanting to fight against it. I don't want to lose her. And I don't want to say goodbye. But I have to. I look down at our interlinked hands and remember how simple things were. At least for a little while. Back when I first moved to Paradise. You know, the first time my telekinesis started working was during that Thanksgiving at your house.
You never told me that.
Sarah replies, an eyebrow raised, not sure why I'm suddenly getting sentimental.
Did my mom's cooking inspire you?
I chuckle. I don't know. Maybe. That was the same night Henri had his run-in with the original They Walk Among Us crew, along with the Mogadorians who were using them. Afterward, he wanted to leave Paradise, and I refused. Actually, I didn't just refuse. I used my telekinesis to pin him to the ceiling.
Sounds like you, Sarah says, shaking her head and smiling. Stubborn.
I told him I couldn't go back to living on the run.
Not after Paradise.
And you.
Oh, John.
Sarah puts her forehead against my chest. I used to think this war wasn't worth fighting if I couldn't be by your side. I tell her, gently lifting her chin. But now, after everything that's happened, after everything I've seen, I realize that I'm fighting for the future. Our future. The dashboard clock looms impossibly large in the corner of my eye. Only 5 minutes left. I focus on Sarah, wishing I had a legacy where I could freeze time or store this moment up. Tears slip down Sarah's cheeks and I wipe them away with my thumbs. She puts her hand over mine, squeezing hard, and I can tell she's trying to steel herself. She takes a deep, shuddering breath and fights back more tears.
I have to go, John.
I trust you, I whisper urgently. I don't mean just to find Mark. If things get bad, I trust you to stay alive. I trust you to come back to me in one piece. Sarah grabs the front of my shirt, pulls me in. I feel a few of her tears against my cheek. I try to let everything go. Missing my friends, the war, her leaving me, and just live for a while in her kiss. I wish I could go back to Paradise with her. Not as it is now, but the way it was months ago. Sneakily making out in my temporary bedroom, while Henri was grocery shopping, stealing looks during class. The easy, normal life. But that's over. We're not kids anymore. We're fighters. Soldiers. And we have to act the part. Sarah pulls away from me and, in one fluid motion, not wanting to drag this painful moment out any longer, she opens the door and hops out of the van. She shoulders her backpack and whistles.
Come on, Bernie Kosar.
BK clambers into the front seat, head cocked at me. As if wondering why I'm not getting out of the van, too. I scratch behind his good ear, and he lets out a little whine. Keep her safe, I tell him telepathically. Bernie Kosar puts both his front paws on my leg and sloppily licks the side of my face. Sarah laughs.
So many goodbye kisses,
she says as BK jumps down from the van. Sarah clips on his leash.
This isn't goodbye, I say. Not really.
You're right, Sarah replies, her smile getting shaky, a note of uncertainty creeping into her voice.
I'll see you soon, John Smith. Stay safe.
See you soon. I love you, Sarah Hart.
I love you, too.
Sarah turns away, hurrying towards the sliding doors of the bus station, Bernie Kosar trotting along at her heels. She looks back at me, only once, right before she disappears through the doors, and I wave. Then she's gone, into the bus station, and eventually off to some secret location in Alabama, searching for a way to help us win this war. I have to stop myself from running after her. So I clutch the steering wheel until my knuckles are white, too white. My lumen kicks in unexpectedly, my hands glowing. I haven't lost control of that since, well, since back in paradise. I take a deep breath and calm myself down, glancing around, making sure no one outside the bus station noticed. I turn the key in the ignition, feel the van rumble to life, and pull away from the bus station. I miss her. I already miss her. I head back towards one of Baltimore's rougher neighborhoods where Sam, Malcolm, and Adam are waiting for me, planning an assault. I know where I'm going and what I'm doing, but I still feel adrift. I remember my brief scuffle with Adam in the destroyed John Hancock penthouse, how I almost fell out the window. That feeling of emptiness behind me, of teetering right next to the edge, that's how I feel now. But then I imagine Sarah's hands pulling me away from that empty space. I imagine what it will be like when we meet again. What it will be like with Cetricus Ra vanquished, and the Mogadorians beaten back into the cold emptiness of space. I imagine the future, and I smile grimly. There's only one way to make that happen. It's time to fight.
Chapter 4. We hike through the darkness, down a muddy road carved out of the swampland, the rhythmic sucking noises from our waterlogged sneakers and the incessant chirping of bugs the only sounds. We pass by a solitary wooden pole, slanted and close to being totally uprooted, the streetlight out, power lines sagging under the overgrown trees, disappearing into them. It's a welcome sign of society after 2 days spent in the swamps, hardly sleeping, turning invisible at the slightest noise, plodding our way through the muck. It was Five who led us into the swampland. He knew the way, of course. It was his ambush. We didn't have an easy time finding our way out. It's not like we could have gone back to the car we drove down here anyway. The Moogs would definitely be watching that. A few steps ahead, Nine slaps the back of his neck, squashing a mosquito. At the noise, Marina flinches, and the field of cold she's been giving off since the fight with Five momentarily intensifies. I'm not sure if Marina's having trouble getting control of her new legacy, or if she's intentionally cooling the air around us. Considering how humid the Florida swamps have been, I guess it hasn't been so bad trekking around with a portable air conditioner. You all right? I ask her quietly, not wanting Nine to overhear, and yet knowing that's impossible with his heightened hearing. She hasn't spoken to Nine since Eight was killed, has barely said anything to me. Marina looks over at me, but in the dark I can't get a read on her. What do you think, Six? She asks. I squeeze her arm and find her skin cool to the touch. We'll get them, I tell her. I'm not much for these leader-style speeches. That's what John does, so I keep it blunt. We'll kill them all. He won't have died in vain. He shouldn't have died at all, she replies. We shouldn't have left him out there. Now they have him, doing Lord knows what to his body. We didn't have a choice, I counter, knowing it's true. After the beating we endured at the hands of Five, We were in no shape to fight off a battalion of Mogadorians backed up by one of their ships. Marina shakes her head and falls silent.
You know, I used to always want Sandor to take me camping,
Nine butts in out of nowhere, looking at us over his shoulder.
I hated living in that cushy-ass penthouse. But man, after this, I sort of miss it.
Marina and I don't respond. That's the way Nine's been talking since our battle with Five. These forced anecdotes about nothing. Weirdly upbeat, like nothing serious happened out here. When he wasn't rambling, Nine made it a habit to hike ahead of us, using his speed to put some distance between us. When we caught up, he'd have already caught some animal, usually snake, and be cooking it over a small fire he built on a rare patch of dry land. It's like he wanted to pretend we were just on some fun camping trip. I'm not squeamish. I'd eat whatever Nine caught. Marina never did, though. I don't think the roasted swamp creatures bothered her so much as the fact it was Nine doing the hunting. She must be running on empty by now. Even more so than me and Nine. After another mile, I noticed the road getting a little more packed down and well-traveled. I can see light up ahead. Soon, the non-stop buzzing of the local insect life gives way to something equally annoying. Country music. I wouldn't exactly call this place a town. I'm sure it doesn't show up on even the most detailed map. It looks more like a campground that people forgot to leave. Or maybe this is just a place where the local hunters come to bro around and escape their wives, I think, noticing an overpopulation of pickup trucks in the nearby gravel parking lot. There are a couple dozen crude huts scattered throughout this cleared stretch of swamp coast, all of them pretty much indistinguishable from an old-school outhouse. The huts basically consist of some pieces of plywood hastily nailed together, and they look like a strong breeze could knock them over. I guess when you're building at the edge of a Florida swamp, there's no point in putting too much effort in. Hung between the huts, lighting this grim little vista, are strings of blinking Christmas lights and a few gas-powered lanterns. Beyond the huts, where the solid ground sinks back into the swamp, there's a rickety dock with a few tied-up pontoon boats. The source of the music, the center of this town, and the only solid structure built here is Trapper's, a skeevy-looking bar housed in a log cabin, the name proudly displayed along the roof in sizzling green neon. A row of stuffed alligators line the bar's wooden porch, their jaws open and searching. From inside, above the music, I can hear men shouting and pool balls cracking.
All right, Nine says, clapping his hands. My kind of place.
The place does sort of remind me of the off-the-grid spots I used to hit up when I was alone and on the run. Places where the tight-knit and gritty locals make it easy to spot out-of-place Mogadorians. Even so, as I notice a scrawny middle-aged guy with a mullet and a tank top staring at us, chain-smoking in the shadows of the porch, I wonder if we should find a safer place for us to poke our heads in. But Nine is already halfway up the creaky wooden steps, Marina right behind him. And so I go along. Hopefully this place has a phone so we can at least get in touch with the others back in Chicago. Check to see how John and Ella are doing. Hopefully better, somehow. Especially now that we know the cure-all Five claimed to have in his chest was a bunch of crap. We have to warn the others about him. Who knows what information he might have been feeding to the Mogadorians? When we push through the swinging saloon doors of Trapper's, the music doesn't screech to a stop like in the movies, but everyone in the bar does turn their heads to stare at us, almost in unison. The place is cramped. Not much to it besides the bar, a pool table, and some beat-up lawn furniture.
It stinks of sweat, kerosene, and alcohol. "Hoo boy," someone says, then whistles loudly. I quickly realize that Marina and I are the only two women here. Hell, we might be the first women to ever set foot inside Trappers. The drunks staring at us range from tremendously overweight to alarmingly skinny, all of them dressed in halfway open plaid shirts or sweat-stained wife beaters, some of them flashing gap-toothed leers, others smoothing down unkempt beards as they size us up. One guy, in a ripped heavy metal t-shirt with a lower lip stuffed with chewing tobacco, breaks away from the pool table to sidle up next to Marina. "This must be my lucky night," the guy drawls, "because you go..." The rest of the pickup line is lost to the ages, because the moment this guy tries to slide his arm around her shoulders, Marina roughly snatches his wrist. I can hear the moisture on his arm crackle as it flash freezes, and a second later the guy is crying out as Marina twists his arm behind his back. "Do not come near me," she says in a measured tone, loud enough so the whole bar knows that the warning doesn't go just for the dude whose arm she's almost breaking. Now the room truly does go quiet. I notice one guy let his beer bottle slip down in his hand so he's holding it by the neck, all the better for swinging. A couple of burly guys at the back table exchange looks and stand up, eyeballing us. For a moment, I think the whole bar might try rushing us. That would end badly for them, and I try to communicate that with my stare. Nine, who with his tangled black hair and dirty face fits right in here, cracks his knuckles and lolls his head back and forth, watching the crowd. Finally, one of the other hicks at the pool table hoots. "Mike, you dumbass! Say excuse me and get over here. It's your shot!" "Sorry," Mike whimpers to Marina, his arm turning blue where she's touching him. She shoves him away, and he goes to rejoin his friends, rubbing his arm and trying to avoid looking at us. Just like that, the tension breaks. Everyone goes back to what they were doing, which pretty much means guzzling beer. I figure scenes similar to that, little fights, stare-downs, maybe a stabbing or two, must happen in Trappers all the time. No big deal. Like I figured, this is one of those places where nobody asks any questions. "Keep it under control," I tell Marina as we walk to the bar. "I am," she replies. "Didn't look like it." Nine reaches the bar a step ahead of us, clearing a space between two hunchback drunks and slapping the chipped wooden surface. The bartender, who looks just a tad more alert and cleaner than his customers, probably because he's wearing an apron, looks us over with weary disapproval. "You should know I keep a shotgun under the bar. I don't want any more trouble," the bartender warns. Nine grins at him. "It's cool, old man. You got anything to eat back there? We're starving." "I could fry you up some burgers," the bartender replies after a moment's thought. "It's not possum meat or something, is it?" Nine asks, then holds up his hands. "Never mind. I don't want to know. Three of your finest, my man." I lean across the bar before the bartender can retreat into the kitchen. "You got a phone?" He jerks his thumb towards the bar's darkened back corner, where I notice a payphone hanging cockeyed from the wall. "You could try that. It works part of the time." "Looks like everything in here only works part of the time," Nine mutters, glancing at the TV mounted above the bar. The reception is bad at the moment, a news report swallowed up by static, the crooked rabbit ears emerging from the set not doing their job. As the bartender disappears into the kitchen, Marina sits down with a couple of stools buffering her from Nine. She avoids eye contact,
engrossed by the popping static on the TV. Meanwhile, Nine drums his hands on the bar, looking around, almost daring one of the drunks to say something to him. I've never felt so much like a babysitter. I'm going to try calling Chicago, I tell them. Before I can go, the scrawny chain smoker from outside squeezes into the space at the bar next to me. He flashes a smirk that's probably supposed to be charming, except he's missing a couple of teeth and it doesn't quite reach his eyes, which look wild and desperate. Hey, honey, he says, obviously having missed Marina's demonstration about what happens when drunks try flirting with us. Buy me a drink and I'll tell you my story. It's a doozy. I stare at him. Get away from me. The bartender returns from the kitchen, the smell of cooking meat coming with him and making my stomach growl. He notices the scrawny guy next to me and immediately snaps his fingers in his face. Thought I told you not to come in here if you don't have any money, Dale, the bartender barks. Go on now. Ignoring the bartender, Dale fixes me with one last pleading look. Seeing that I won't be budged, he slinks down the bar to beg one of the other patrons for a drink. I shake my head and take a deep breath. I need to get out of this place. I need a shower, and I need to hit something. I'm trying to keep it cool, to be rational about things, especially considering my two companions aren't acting all that stable. But I'm angry. Furious, really. Five knocked me out, practically took my head clean off. In that time I was unconscious, the whole world changed. I know I couldn't have seen it coming. I never expected one of our own would turn traitor, even a freak like Five. Still, I can't help but feel it would have been different if I'd had my guard up. If I'd been fast enough to dodge that first punch, Eight might still be alive. I didn't even get a chance to fight, and it makes me feel cheated and useless. I bottle that rage up, saving it for the next time I see a Mogadorian. Six, Marina says, her voice suddenly fragile, not so distant and cold. Look at this. The TV over the bar has started coming in, a rolling band of static disrupting the picture now and then, but a news broadcast is otherwise clearly visible. On it, a windblown reporter stands in front of a line of police tape, the John Hancock Center looming in the background. What the hell? I say under my breath. The roof shakes from a sudden peal of thunder outside. That was me, letting some of that rage slip. The newscast switches over from the reporter to taped footage of the top floors of the John Hancock Center, in flames. This can't be happening, Marina says, her eyes wide, looking to me for confirmation that this is just some sick joke. I've been trying to be the stable one, but I can't find anything reassuring to say. The bartender clicks his tongue, watching the TV, too. Crazy, right? Freaking terrorists. I lunge across the bar and grab him by the front of his apron before he can even think of reaching for his hidden shotgun. When did this happen? I snap. Damn, girl, the bartender says, sensing something in my eyes that makes him decide not to struggle. I don't know, like 2 days ago? It's been all over the news. Where the hell you been? Getting our asses handed to us, I mutter, and shove him away. I try to pull myself together, to beat back the panic. Nine's been completely silent since the report came on. When I look over at him, his expression is completely blank. He stares at the television, watching footage of our penthouse headquarters and his former home burning. His mouth open just a little, his body completely still, almost rigid. He looks like he's shutting down, as if his brain isn't capable of processing this latest blow. "Nine," I start, and my voice breaks his trance. Without a word to me or Marina, without so much as a look, he spins around and heads for the door. One of the pool players isn't quick enough to get out of Nine's way and gets shouldered to the floor. Trusting that Marina won't freeze anyone to death in my absence, I chase after Nine. By the time I'm out on Trapper's porch, Nine has already made it into the parking lot, stalking intently towards the gravel road. "Where are you going?" I shout after him, hopping the porch railing and jogging to catch up. "Chicago," he answers bluntly. "You're going to walk to Chicago?" I ask him. "That's your plan?" "Good point," he replies, not slowing down. "I'll steal a car. You guys coming or what?" "Stop being an idiot," I snap. And when that doesn't slow him down, I reach out with my telekinesis and grab him. I turn him around so he's facing me, his heels digging divots in the gravel as he tries to fight. "Let me go, Six," Nine growls. "Let me go right now." "Stop and think for a second," I insist, realizing as I start that I'm not just trying to convince Nine, but also myself. My fingernails dig into my palms. Not sure if that's from the concentration required to hold Nine with my telekinesis, or from me straining to keep it together. Back on the roof of the John Hancock Center, I'd told Sam that we were at war and that there would be casualties. I'd thought I was prepared for that, but losing 8? And now maybe losing the others in Chicago? No, I can't handle that. That can't have been my last conversation with Sam. It can't. "They wouldn't be in Chicago anymore," I continue. "They'd run. That's what we'd do. And we know John is still alive, or we'd have another scar. He's got the tablet. He's got his chest. They've got a better chance of finding us than we have of finding them. Last time I saw John, he was comatose. He's not up for finding anyone." "An exploding building tends to wake a person up," I counter. "He got out. We'd know if he didn't." After a moment, Nine nods reluctantly. "All right. All right, let me go." I let him loose from my telekinetic hold. He looks away immediately, peering down the darkened road, his broad shoulders slumped. "I feel like we're screwed, Six," Nine says, his voice hoarse. "Like we already lost and no one's got around to telling us." I walk up next to him and put my hand on his shoulder. Our backs to the neon light of Trapper's, I can't really see Nine's face, but I'm pretty sure his eyes are wet with tears. "Bullshit," I reply. "We don't lose." "Tell that to 8.
"Nine, come on."
Nine shoves both his hands through his tangled black hair, almost like he's going to pull some out. Then he brings his hands down over his face, rubbing it. When he drops them back to his sides, I can tell he's trying to be stoic. "It was my fault, too," he continues. "I got him killed."
"That's not true."
"It is. 5 kicked my ass and I couldn't help myself. Had to keep talking, had to show him. It should have been me. You know it, I know it. Marina damn sure knows it." I take my hand off Nine's shoulder and punch him in the jaw.
"Ow! Damn it!"
he yelps, staggering away from me and nearly losing his footing in the gravel.
"What the hell?
Is that what you want?" I ask, stepping towards him, fists clenched and ready. "Want me to kick your ass a little bit? Punish you for what happened to 8? Nine holds up his hands. "Cut it out, Six."
"It wasn't your fault," I tell him evenly, unclenching my fists and then jabbing him hard in the chest with my fingers.
5 killed 8, not you. And the Mogadorians are to blame. Got it?"
"Yeah, I got it," Nine replies, although I can't be sure if I've actually gotten through to him or if he just wants me to stop assaulting him. Good. Enough with this mopey crap. We need to figure out what we're doing next. I've already figured that out, Marina chimes in. I was so intent on beating some sense into Nine that I didn't hear her approaching. Neither did Nine, and I can tell by the embarrassed look on his face that he's wondering how much Marina overheard. At the moment, Marina doesn't seem concerned with Nine's meltdown. She's too busy dragging along the scrawny guy from the bar, Dale, the one who wanted to trade me his awesome story for a beer. Marina leads him across the parking lot towards us, holding his ear like a cruel teacher escorting a delinquent to the principal's office. I notice the slightest coating of frost forming on the side of Dale's face. Marina, let him go, I say. She complies, yanking Dale ahead of her so that he stumbles into the gravel, ending up on his knees right in front of me. I give her a look. I understand where the violent streak comes from, but I don't like it. Marina ignores me. Tell them what you told me, Marina orders Dale. Your amazing story. Dale looks at the three of us, eager to please yet obviously terrified, probably thinking we're going to kill him if he doesn't listen. There's an old NASA base out in the swamp. Got decommissioned in the 80s when the swamp started rising, Dale begins haltingly, rubbing the side of his face to warm it up. I go out there sometimes, looking for stuff I can sell. Normally it's deserted, but last night, man, I swear I saw UFOs floating around out there. Creepy guys who didn't look right with guns like I ain't never seen guarding the place. You ain't with them, are you? No, I answer. We most definitely are not. Dale's volunteered to show us the way, Marina says, nudging Dale with the toe of her sneaker. He swallows hard and then nods enthusiastically. It's not far, he says. Couple hours through the swamp. We just spent 2 days hiking out of that swamp, Nine says. Now you want us to go back in? They have him, Marina hisses, pointing into the dark. You heard Malcolm's story about what they did to Number One? They stole her legacies. I give Marina a sharp look. Even if most of it doesn't make any sense to him, Dale's still listening intently to our conversation. Should we really be talking about this? Marina snorts. You're worried about Dale, Six? They're killing us and blowing up our friends. Keeping secrets from this drunk is the least of our worries. Dale raises his hand. I swear I won't say nothing about whatever you're talking about. What about Chicago? Nine asks. What about the others? Marina affords Nine only a quick glare. She keeps her eyes on me when she answers. You know I'm worried about them, but we don't know where John and the others are, Six. We know where Eight is, and I am not, under any circumstances, letting those sick bastards keep him. The way she says it, I know there's no way to convince Marina otherwise. If we don't go with her, she'll go by herself. Not that I even consider not going. I'm spoiling for a fight almost as bad as she is. And if there's a chance Eight's body is still out there, in the clutches of Mogadorians still lingering in Florida, maybe with Five, then we have to at least try recovering it. Leave no guard behind. Dale, I say, I hope you've got a boat we can borrow.
Chapter 5. The slab of meat in front of me looks like a soggy piece of uncooked fish, except it's lacking any texture whatsoever. I poke it with my fork and the pale slab jiggles like gelatin. Or maybe it's still alive and trying to escape. Those unappetizing tremors, its attempt to slowly wiggle off my plate. If I look away, I wonder if the thing will pick up the pace and try crawling into one of the air vents. I want to vomit.
Eat,
Cedricus Ra commands. He called himself my grandfather. That thought makes me more nauseous than the food. I don't want to believe him. This could be just like the visions, some sick game meant to get under my skin. But why go through all the trouble? Why bring me here? Why not just kill me? Cedricus Ross sits across from me, all the way down at the opposite end of the ridiculously large banquet table that looks as if it was carved from lava. His chair is throne-like, made of the same dark stone as the table, but definitely not large enough to accommodate the mammoth warlord we fought at Tulsi Base. No, at some point when I wasn't watching, Cedricus Ra shrunk down to a more reasonable 8 feet tall, so that he could comfortably hunch over his own plate of Mogadorian cuisine. Could his size changing be a legacy? It works really similarly to my ability to alter my age.
You have questions,
Cedricus Ra rumbles, observing me. What are you? I blurt out. He cocks his head.
What do you mean, child?
You're a Mogadorian, I say, trying not to sound too frantic. I'm Lorik. We can't be related.
Ah, such a simplistic idea. Human, Lorik, Mogadorian. These are just words, dear one. Labels. Centuries ago, my experiments proved that our genetics could be changed. They could be augmented. We needn't wait for Lorien to gift us with legacies. We could take them as we needed them, utilizing them like any other resource.
Why do you keep saying we? I ask, my voice cracking. You're not one of us. Cedricus Ross smiles thinly.
I was Lorik once. The 10th Elder. Until the time came when I was cast out. Then I became what you see before you. The powers of a guard combined with the strength of a Mogadorian. An evolutionary improvement.
My legs start shaking under the table. I hardly listen after he mentions the 10th Elder. I remember that from Creighton's letter. He said my father was obsessed with the fact that our family once had an elder. Could that have been Cedricus Ra? You're crazy, I say, and you're a liar.
I am neither of those things,
he replies patiently.
I am a realist, a futurist. I altered my genetics to become more like them, so they would accept me. In return for their fealty, I helped their population grow. I brought them back from the brink of extinction. Joining the Mogadorians gave me a chance to continue the experiments that so frightened the Lorik. Now, my work is almost finished. Soon all life in the universe, Mogadorian, human, even what's left of the Lorik, will be improved under my gently guiding hand.
You didn't improve life on Lorien, I snap back. You killed them all.
They opposed progress,
Cedricus Ra states, like the death of a whole planet is nothing. You're sick. I'm not afraid to talk back to him. I know that he won't hurt me. Not yet, at least. He's too vain for that. Wants too badly to convert another Lorik to the cause. He wants things to be just like in my nightmare. Since I woke up here, he's had a team of female Mogadorians attending to me. They dress me in this long black formal gown, very similar to the one I was wearing in my vision. It itches like crazy, and I have to keep tugging at the neckline. I stare openly at his hideous face, hating myself for trying to find some resemblance. His head is bulbous and pale, covered in intricate Mogadorian tattoos. His eyes are empty and black, just like the Mogs. His teeth are filed down and sharp. If I look hard enough, I can almost see the Lorik cast to his features, like crumbling architecture buried beneath the paleness and gross Moog artwork. Cetricus Ra looks up from his food, meeting my gaze. Facing him head-on still gives me a chill, and I have to force myself not to turn away.
"Eat,"
he says again.
"You need your strength."
I hesitate for a moment, not sure how far I should push my insubordination, but also really not wanting to sample the Moog version of sushi. I make a point of dropping my fork so that it clatters loudly against the side of my plate. It echoes in the high-ceilinged room, Cetricus Ra's private dining area, which is only slightly more furnished than the other cold rooms aboard the Anubis. The walls are covered in paintings of Mogadorians bravely charging into combat. The ceiling is open, providing a breathtaking view of Earth, the planet imperceptibly rotating below us.
"Do not push me, girl," Cetricus Ra growls. "Do as you're told."
I push my plate away from me. "I'm not hungry." He studies me, a condescending look in his eyes, like a parent trying to show a bratty child how patient they can be.
"I can put you back to sleep and feed you through a tube if you prefer. Perhaps you'd be better mannered when I next woke you, once the war was won,"
he says.
"But then we wouldn't be able to talk. You wouldn't be able to enjoy your grandfather's victory firsthand, and you wouldn't be able to entertain your futile notions of escape."
I swallow hard. I know we'll be going down to Earth eventually. Cetricus Ra isn't going to have his warships orbit Earth for a while and then float peacefully away. There's going to be an invasion. I've been telling myself that once we land, I'd have a chance to run for it. Obviously, Cetricus Ra knows that I'd rather die than be his prisoner, or his co-ruler, or whatever he's got in mind. But, from the smug look on his face, he doesn't seem to care. Maybe he thinks he can brainwash me before we return to Earth. "How am I supposed to eat with your nasty face right there?" I ask him, hoping to see his self-satisfied look falter. "It's not exactly appetizing." Cetricus Ra stares at me like he's trying to decide whether to leap across the table and throttle me. After a moment, he reaches to the side of his chair where his cane is propped. Ornately carved from a shimmering golden metal with an ominous black eye on the handle. It's the same cane I saw Cetricus Ra use during the fight at Dulce Base. I brace myself for an attack.
"The Eye of Thalok,"
Cetricus Ra says, noticing me eyeing the staff.
"Like Earth, it will one day be part of your inheritance."
Before I can ask a follow-up question, the obsidian eye in the cane's handle flashes. I flinch, but it quickly becomes clear that I'm not in any danger. Instead, it's Cetricus Ra who begins to convulse. Bands of red and purple light project from the Eye of Thalok and scan over his body. Although I don't exactly know how, I can sense energy moving from the cane into Cetricus Ra. He writhes and contorts as his skin peels away from his body, expanding outward and shifting, like a bubble forming in candle wax. When it's over, Cetricus Ra looks human. Actually, he looks like a movie star. He's assumed the form of a handsome older guy in his mid-40s, with immaculately arranged salt-and-pepper hair, soulful blue eyes, and just a modest amount of stubble. He's tall, but no longer intimidatingly so, and he's wearing a stylish blue suit and pressed dress shirt, casually open at the collar. Of his previous appearance, only the three Lorik pendants remain, their cobalt jewels matching his shirt.
"Better?"
he asks, his usual scratchy voice replaced by this man's smooth baritone.
"What?"
I look at him, dumbfounded.
"Who are you supposed to be?"
"I choose this form for the humans," he explains. "Our research shows they're naturally drawn to middle-aged, Caucasian men of these specifications. Apparently, they find them leaderly and trustworthy."
"Why?" I try to gather my thoughts. "What do you mean it's for the humans?" Cedricus Ra gestures towards my plate.
"Eat, and I will answer your questions. That's not unreasonable, is it? I believe the humans call it quid pro quo."
I look down at my plate and the pale blob waiting for me there. I think about 6 and 9 and the rest of the guard and wonder what they would do in my situation. It seems like Cetricus Ra wants to spill his guts, so I should probably let him. Maybe, while he's trying to subtly win me over, he'll let slip the secret to beating the Mogadorians, if that even exists. Either way, taking a bite of the boiled slug on my plate seems like a small price to pay if it means gathering some important information. I shouldn't think of my situation as being held prisoner. It's more like I'm on a mission behind enemy lines. I'm a freaking spy. I pick up my knife and fork, cut a small square off the edge of the meat, and plop it into my mouth. There's hardly any taste at all. It's almost like chewing a wadded-up ball of notebook paper. It's the texture that really bothers me, the way the meat starts to fizz and melt as soon as it touches my tongue, breaking down so quickly that I don't even really chew. I can't help but think of the way Mogadorians disintegrate when they're killed and have to stop myself from gagging.
"It isn't what you're used to, but it's the best the Anubis is equipped to produce,"
Cetricus Ra says, almost apologetically.
"The food will improve once we've taken Earth."
I ignore him, not really caring about the finer points of Mogadorian cuisine. "I ate. Now answer my question." He inclines his head, looking charmed by my directness.
"I chose this form because the humans will find it comforting. It's what I will wear to accept surrender of their planet."
I gape at him. "They're not going to surrender to you." He smiles.
"Of course they will. Unlike the Lorik, who pointlessly fight against impossible odds, the humans have a rich history of subjugation. They appreciate demonstrations of superior force and will gladly accept the tenets of Mogadorian progress. And those who don't will perish."
"Mogadorian progress," I spit the words. "What are you even talking about? You're going to make everyone like you a mon-" I don't finish my question. I was going to call him a monster, but then I thought back to my vision. I callously ordered Six's execution right in front of John, Sam, and a crowd of people. What if something like Cetricus Ra is already lurking inside me?
"I believe there was at least one question in all that vitriol,"
Cetricus Ra says. He maintains his infuriating smile, made even worse now that he's wearing a handsome human face, and gestures towards my plate. I shovel down another bite of the horrible food. He clears his throat like he's about to give a speech.
"We share the same blood, granddaughter, which is why you will be spared the fate of those guard who foolishly oppose me. Because, unlike them, You are capable of change, Cetricus Ra explains. I may have been Loric once, but over the centuries I have made myself into something better. Once I control the Earth, I will have the power necessary to change the lives of billions. All they need to do is accept Mogadorian progress. Then my work will at last bear fruit.
I squint at him. Power? From where?
Cetricus Ra smiles at me, touching the pendants that hang around his neck. You will see when the time is right, child. Then you will understand.
I already understand, I reply. I understand that you are a disgusting, genocidal freak who gave himself a bad Mogadorian makeover.
Cetricus Ra's smile flickers, and for a moment, I wonder if I've pushed my luck too far. He sighs and drags his fingers across his throat, the skin of his assumed form parting to reveal the thick purple scar around his throat.
Pittacus Lore gave me this when he tried to kill me, he says, his voice cold and level. I was one of them. But he and the other elders cast me out, banished me from Lorien because of my ideas.
What? Did they not want to elect you supreme ruler or something?
Cetricus Ra passes his hand across his throat once again, and the scar tissue disappears.
They already had a ruler,
Cetricus Ra replies, his voice dropping lower, as if the memory makes him angry.
They just refused to admit it.
What's that supposed to mean?
This time, he doesn't make me take a bite of food. He's on a roll now.
My dear, the elders were ruled by the planet itself. Lorien made their choices for them. Who would be guard and who would be Saipan? They believed we should live as caretakers and let nature determine our fates. I disagreed. The legacies granted by Lorien are simply a resource, like anything else. Would you let the fish in the ocean dictate who is fit to eat them? Or allow the iron in the ground to decide when to be forged? Of course not.
I try to digest all this information and compare it with what I learned from Creighton and his letter. You just wanted to be in control, I say after a moment.
I wanted progress, he counters. The Mogadorians understood. Unlike the Loric, they were people ready to be elevated.
You're insane, I say, pushing my plate away, done with this whole question and answer thing.
You are an unenlightened child,
he replies, that condescending patience back.
When your studies begin, when you see what I have accomplished for you, and what the Loric have denied you, then you will understand. You will come to love and respect me.
I stand up, even though I have nowhere to go.
Cetricus Ra has been gentle with me so far, but it's been made crystal clear that I can only move around the sterile hallways of the Anubis as he allows it. If he wants to keep me here and force me to finish my dinner, he will. It would probably be smoother for me if I let all his distortions and half-truths go unchallenged. But I just can't do it. I think of 9, 6, and the others. I know they'd never hold their tongue when faced with this monster. You destroyed our planet, and all you've ever accomplished is hurting people, I say, trying to mimic my grandfather's mocking patience. You're a monster. I will never not hate you. Cetricus Ra sighs, his handsome features creasing briefly in consternation.
Anger is the last refuge of the ignorant, he says, holding up his hand. Let me show you something they denied you, granddaughter.
A coil of bright red energy begins to swirl around his raised hand. Nervous,
I take a step backwards.
The elders chose who would escape from Lorien, and you were not meant to be among them.
Cedricus Ra continued.